Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Today is Wednesday, November the 13th, 2019. There are 16 days before Black Friday. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m., Eastern Time, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the headlines, the Apple credit card. T-Mobile's nationwide 600 MHz 5G network will launch on December the 6th. Amazon Ring doorbells exposed home Wi-Fi passwords to hackers. AT&T switches customers to more expensive plans without asking them first. Microsoft new Office mobile app. Benjamin Rockwell, data failure might mean company failure. Do batteries last longer in the refrigerator? When to replace the rechargeable battery? Marty Winston, what if we could directly get our house to know the weather to make adjustments automatically? The Apple credit card. The Apple card is promoted as a new kind of credit card created by Apple. It is built on the principles of simplicity, transparency, and privacy. No annual late or foreign transaction fees. Best of all, there are no hidden fees. Apple Card completely rethinks everything about the credit card. The New York Department of Financial Services is looking into allegations of gender discrimination against users of the Apple Card, which is administered by Goldman Sachs. The allegations blew up on Twitter Saturday after tech entrepreneur David Heinemeier Hansen wrote that Apple Card offered him 20 times a credit limit as his wife, although they have shared assets and she has a higher credit score. Hansen wrote that after reaching out to Apple in an attempt to rectify the situation, he was told credit limits are determined by an algorithm. Hansen, in his Twitter thread, said the program's decision to offer his wife such a low credit limit was so striking that they feared her identity had been stolen and they paid to check her credit score. Finding it was higher than his, Hansen is a founder and chief technology officer at web development firm Basecamp. Many other users voiced similar experiences, including Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Wozniak said his credit limit was 10 times that of his wife, despite the fact that they share all assets and accounts. But these allegations highlight the challenges inherent in letting artificial intelligence, who has been shown in a number of contexts to be biased, making decisions like how much credit to extend to a user. Wozniak, who co-founded Apple with Steve Jobs and continues to work for the company, said on Twitter that he and his wife had a similar experience with the Apple Card. Though they share all of the assets and accounts, he was offered 10 times the credit limit of his wife. Some say the blame is on Goldman Sachs, but the way Apple's attached, they should share responsibility, Steve Wozniak said. AI-powered algorithms have been problematic in the past. Researchers have found facial recognition software has trouble identifying women of color, and software used to sentence criminals was found to be biased against Black Americans. That could be an issue as AI technology underpins everything from the speech recognition that makes smart speakers like Siri work to the technology that allows autonomous vehicles to drive themselves, and in the case of the Apple Card, consumer credit assessments. Artificial intelligence, or AI, are conditional program steps written by a programmer. The accuracy of AI is no worse or better than the human programmer who wrote the instructions. The mystique that it was determined by computer masks the fact that the algorithm bias was human and not machine. Financial services companies are responsible for ensuring the algorithm they use do not unintentionally discriminate against protected groups. And it is not the first time a tech company has been accused of facilitating discrimination in access to financial services. Facebook is facing a proposed class action lawsuit that alleges that ads for financial services such as loans and insurance coverage on the platform was targeted away from women and older people over the past 3 years. The lesson that we learn from artificial intelligence is that it is humans that write the programs. And one day when we are talking about all cars are autonomous, you have to be careful what algorithms are being used, and they should be carefully audited and monitored. T-Mobile's nationwide 600 MHz 5G network will launch on December the 6th. T-Mobile's nationwide 5G network, built on the company's 600 MHz band of spectrum, will launch on the 6th of December. This marks the largest rollout for the carrier's 5G plans yet. T-Mobile has also started rolling out its 5G network on a smaller scale with faster but short-range millimeter wave technology in a few cities similar to Verizon. Millimeter wave spectrum is the band of spectrum between 30 GHz and 300 GHz, wedged between microwave and infrared waves. This spectrum can be used for high-speed wireless communications as seen with the 802.11ad Wi-Fi standard operating at 60 GHz. The 600 MHz half of the network looks to help make up for the shortcomings of millimeter wave networks, like the short range and difficulties of getting signals into buildings. The network will eventually cover 200 million customers and hit speeds up to 450 megabits by 2024, which is 10 times faster than its current LTE speeds. We'll have to wait and see for ourselves how well those claims hold up in the real world, along with how the slower 600 MHz flavor 5G compares to the higher spectrum millimeter wave version. The list of devices that can actually work with T-Mobile's 5G network is a lot more limited, though. At launch, T-Mobile will have just two 5G phones, Samsung Galaxy Note 10 Plus 5G and the OnePlus 7T Pro 5G. T-Mobile also announced a new Connecting Heroes initiative, which promises free, unlimited talk, text, and 5G internet for U.S. law enforcement, fire, and EMS services. China has officially launched research and development work for 6G mobile networks. The country only just turned on its 5G networks earlier this month, ahead of an initial 2020 schedule. To be clear, 5G is still in its infancy, with most people around the world still on 4G networks. The short answer is 6G is likely what we'll call whatever advanced data networks come after 5G, and 5G is what carriers are currently building as the next generation after 4G LTE. But so far, 6G exists largely as a theoretical concept and is a long way from being deployed in the real world. Amazon Ring doorbells exposed home Wi-Fi passwords to hackers. Security researchers have discovered a vulnerability in Ring doorbells that exposed the passwords for the Wi-Fi networks to which they were connected. Bitdefender said the Amazon-owned doorbell was sending owners Wi-Fi passwords in clear text as the doorbell joins a local network, allowing nearby hackers to intercept a Wi-Fi password and gain access to the network to launch larger attacks or conduct surveillance. When first configuring the device, the smartphone app must send the wireless network credentials. This takes place in an unsecure manner through an unprotected access point, said Bitdefender. Once this network is up, the app connects to it automatically, queries the device, then sends the credentials to the local network. But all of this is carried out over an unencrypted connection, exposing the Wi-Fi password that is sent over the air. Amazon fixed a vulnerability in all Ring devices in September, but the vulnerability was only now disclosed. It's another example of smart home technology suffering from security issues. As much as smart home devices are designed to make our lives easier and homes more secure, Researchers keep finding vulnerabilities that allow them to get access to the very thing they're trying to protect. Earlier this year, flaws in a popular smart home hub allow researchers to break into a person's home by triggering a smart lock to unbolt the door. Amazon has faced intense scrutiny in recent months for Ring's work with law enforcement. Several news outlets have detailed the close relationship Ring has with police departments, including their Ring-related messaging. It was reported this week that Ring had bragged on Instagram about tracking millions of trick-or-treaters this Halloween. This would not have happened if developers worked with security researchers, or at the minimum, the product went through the process of quality assurance and usability testing. Usability testing is designed to emulate how end users will use the product and to determine if they have any issues with it. Feedback from these tests allow the development team to gain a better understanding of their product from the user's perspective. It just seems these practices used to develop enterprise systems are not carried over to consumer-based application programs running on personal computers. AT&T switches customers to more expensive plans without asking them first. You think they would really do that? Of course they did. AT&T adds 15 gigabyte bonus to older plans, but raises price $10. AT&T is adding $10 to the monthly bills of customers with certain grandfathered mobile data plans and not letting them switch back to their older packages. AT&T is pitching the change as a bonus because it also is adding 15 gigabytes to the customer's monthly data allotments. Enjoy more data, AT&T says in a support document. Starting with your October 2019 bill, you'll get an additional 15 gigabytes of data on your mobile share plan. This bonus data comes with a $10 price increase. Paying an extra $10 for another 15 gigabyte, well, isn't a bad idea as far as U.S. wireless prices go, but that's only true if you actually need the extra data. The plan's getting the data and price increases already had between 20 gigabyte and 60 gigabyte of data per month at prices that range from $100 to $225. Now those plans have 35 gigabytes to 75 gigabytes and cost $110 to $235. The data allotments can be shared among multiple peoples on the same family plan. These mobile share value plans were introduced in December of 2013 and are apparently no longer offered to new customers. This is at least the second time this year that AT&T has added $10 and extra data to customer bills. A previous increase took effect between March and May and mostly affected a different set of mobile share value plans, according to another AT&T support document. You want to opt out? No way to opt out. AT&T confirmed there's no way to opt out of the new $10 increase. We are communicating with some customers regarding changes to their mobile plans. Customers have the choice to change their plans at any time and can always contact us with questions as to understand their options. This is what AT&T told, and they also said that the option to change plans doesn't include going back to the older, cheaper ones. The benefits for AT&T are clear. The company gets another $10 a month from customers and probably won't actually have to supply the extra data in most cases. If customers need more data than they already had, they probably would have changed to different plans already. The other benefit for AT&T is that customers hit with a price increase may decide to switch to one of AT&T's newer plans, some of which have data limits and some of which are unlimited. If you're switching to a new plan, make sure to check the fine print. Even the plans advertised as unlimited have plenty of limits. Well, is there a way to opt out? Yeah, cancel the plan and just move on to another vendor. Microsoft Office Suite for smartphones. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Or is there? Just 5 years ago, Microsoft Office Suite for iPad, iPhone, and Android was released. In a surprise move, Office strategy to keep consumers hooked to Word, Excel, and PowerPoint documents was to make it free. Free mobile Office sounds crazy, But is it really? Microsoft's plans might have sound crazy to most, and at first glance, it's easy to come to that conclusion. But the company argues it's a matter of moving its free web apps to mobile. Microsoft had allowed the company to open up editing functionality to mobile clients. They wanted to make sure that their customers can be productive across all devices they have. While consumers using Office Mobile will be able to access the apps for free, Microsoft did not extend this free functionality to businesses. An Office 365 subscription will be required to edit documents. A clear signal of how Microsoft will continue to generate money from the thousands of businesses that rely on its productivity suite and cloud platform. There will still be subscription value, most clearly and easily identifiable in the commercial space, but also in the consumer space around advanced authoring, analysis, presentation, and unlimited storage. Microsoft also rested some chart element customization and track changes to paid customers, making them premium features. Microsoft wants to keep people hooked on Office. It was a strategic move by Microsoft to keep Office competition out of the mobile space. It's all too easy for competitors to build rival products and ship them for free on iPad, iPhone, and Android, offering premium features on top. Microsoft's Office suite is dominant, which also meant it's ripe for disruption if there's a rival Office iPad app that's free and easy to use. That could tempt consumers away from their preconceived reliance on Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. The nightmare situation for Microsoft is that consumers realize soon they don't need Office to create their resume or personal documents, so why should they pay for it on a smartphone or tablet where they're used to getting free apps? Last week, Microsoft, in a press release, shared a new vision for how people get work done on a phone, a new app that's ambitious enough to simply be called Office. The new Office app combines the existing Word, Excel, and PowerPoint mobile apps into a single app in which all Office documents are together in one place. This reduces the need to switch between multiple apps and reduces the amount of space used on your phone compared to multiple installed apps. There are added new capabilities, such as the camera, to enable you to create content in uniquely mobile ways, and a new actions pane to help you accomplish many of the common mobile tasks all from one place. Office is designed to be a go-to app for getting work done on a mobile device. What makes it different from the Microsoft Office on the desktop or notebook? Word, Excel, and PowerPoint all in one app with all of the mobile features you already know and use. Easily get to recent and recommended documents stored in the cloud or on your device, or search for documents across your organization if using a work account. Easy access to sticky notes to jot down quick reminders and ideas. Snap a picture of a document that turn it into an editable Word file with the press of a button. Transform a picture of a table into an Excel spreadsheet so you can work with the data. Let PowerPoint help you design a presentation by simply selecting the pictures you want to use from your phone. Create automatically enhanced digital images of whiteboards and documents with Office Lens features integrated into the app. Create PDFs with your camera using photos on your device or from Office documents. Sign PDFs by simply using your finger. Scan QR codes to open files and links. And easily transfer files between your phone and computer or share instantly with nearby mobile devices. The Office mobile apps is available in public preview for Android and iOS. Anyone can download and use it for free, and they don't require a sign-in to start using it. However, logging in with a work, school, or personal Microsoft account gives you access to your files stored in the cloud, and you can sign in with more than one account to make it easy to get to all of your documents in one place. The app is currently available only on phones, and they expect to bring this experience to tablets as well. Since this is a public preview, they are very interested in hearing from you about what you like, don't like, and would like to see in the app. They encourage you to provide feedback. Translation. The mobile product is a beta. It is free. What we don't know is if the product will continue to be free when it is officially released and not in beta. Many are probably wondering, what does this mean for the current mobile apps? Microsoft will continue to support and invest in the existing Word, Excel, and PowerPoint mobile apps. They do encourage everyone to give the new Office app a try. For iPhone users, the public preview for iOS apps is restricted to a maximum capacity of 10,000 users. The public preview for the Android version of the Office app is not subject to the same download limits and continues to be available for download. By and large, they want that core authoring experience in front of all the users that love Office on any device they choose. That core authoring experience can keep Office users hooked, and Microsoft doesn't want to face a future where consumers and eventually businesses are no longer obsessed over Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. There's also a play here to get consumers using OneDrive cloud storage and a Microsoft account. Both of these can help Microsoft tempt consumers over to Office 365 for additional storage and the added benefit of Office for PC and Mac as part of a subscription. It's a bold move from Microsoft, but also a defensive one. We'll keep an eye out for more to come from Office. Microsoft competition will now have to look elsewhere to plot their Office attack. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on his continuing IT Pro series. Data failure might mean company failure.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is the time where I put on the work hat, or actually in this case, the hard hat, because we're entering into a disaster. Yeah. This is where I'm going to talk about things you hear about at the office. You're not quite sure about the deeper aspects. And in this case, I'm going to talk to you about an item that is, as I record this, unfolding for a friend of mine. Today, I am addressing the world of the IT professional and disaster recovery. Now, I'm going to read off some statistics throughout this. These are from different sources, and some of these are a little bit different in the numbers, but the key concern here is, well, they're all various studies that have found various bits and pieces of very scary items about what happens when you don't have backups, when you have critical data failures, when you have something go absolutely wrong. So I have a friend who works for a company that has been hit by ransomware. This company employs somewhere around 150 people at his location and about 1,000 people company-wide. All right, so this is, you know, we're talking still in the small to medium-sized business category, SMB, and there's a lot to this. They were hit by ransomware across multiple locations, and they're struggling. The old figures, back about 10 years ago, if you were without your data, without your computer systems for a day, there was a chance, there was a 10% chance that your company would have a major meltdown by the end of the year. And these days, that's a little bit different. The thing was, if you went a week without computers, it would be a 50-50 chance in a small to medium-sized business. I mean, you think about all of the impact that happens in various companies. When we're talking about a matter of a week without computers, we're talking about a week where you're not actually getting any work done. Everybody is running around trying to fix things instead of actually bringing in money. That is, you know, that's a hit on the bottom line. And it's going to vary based on, you know, the profit margins that the company has and what kind of different things they're dealing with. One of the things they're dealing with, though, is reputation. And these days, if you have a data loss, you are probably under a variety of contracts to reveal that data loss. So the latest numbers that I've found are that 94% of companies that experience severe data loss do not recover. 51% of those companies close within 2 years of the data loss. 43% of these companies do not reopen again. 70% of small firms go out of business within a year of a large data loss incident. You've got some scary numbers here. Another one that says that 30% of businesses have no disaster recovery strategy in place, and that 90% of businesses without a disaster recovery plan will fail after a disaster. One in three businesses were unprepared for a disaster despite having a plan. So we put these things together and we start to realize that cyber attacks, all of these different ransomware items that happen, can kill a company. 22% of small businesses cease business after a ransomware attack. That's because some of these ransomware, basically they're hijacking your data. They're taking your information and encrypting it and holding it hostage for ransom. In many cases, it's matters of hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars. And they've got not really a good clue as to how much you can hold a company hostage for. In some cases, the company looks at it and goes, we aren't in a position to pay that. Yeah, we've heard of these various cities around the country which have been hit by cyber attacks. And we think of even local governments as having bottomless pockets. What they'll do is they'll raise taxes and they'll figure out a way to pay the money most of the time, some of the time. But we also wind up in a situation with some of these companies in some of these different cities where, yes, we start getting involved with the FBI and major crime bureaus in various forms, however they are, all trying to stop this from happening. I'm going to tell you right now. Every company out there needs, and I'm going to basically list off three major plans. Your company should have a data backup plan. Now, I used to work for a company, and my data backup plan was absolutely insane. They told me, you are out of your mind. I said, you know what, I may be out of my mind, but if something happens someday, I'll be able to bring this company back even if the entire server system and all of the desktops go down. I can be back online and functional with the company within 24 to 48 hours. Why is that? Well, because I backed this up. A, we had our primary backup system. We had my primary desktop system. I backed up the most important data every day to my desktop system. I also backed it up on a rotating basis through three different external hard drives that were on site and three more external hard drives that I rotated off site on a weekly basis to a place called Iron Mountain, where we can store all of this data. So, yeah. That's a data backup plan. Then there's something called the disaster recovery plan. And that disaster recovery plan says, hey, what do we do in the event of a complete and total disaster with our computer systems? So my disaster recovery plan, yes, took into account all kinds of different things that could go wrong. And yes, my data backup plan, my inventories, my various different bits and pieces of prioritization of how we're going to bring data back online, that was all in that big, huge disaster recovery plan. One of the things I even did with that was I sourced out the hardware. I knew all of the hardware that I would need to buy at a moment's notice if we had to impose the ultimate worst-case scenario disaster recovery plan. And the very direct phone numbers. We're talking the business line. We're talking cell phones, home phones, everything for all of the people that I would need to contact in the event of, yes, a complete and total disaster. Yes, hey, Joe, I need a server. Well, no, actually, no, I need three servers and a SAN right away. How right away? Yes, can you have me pick it up anywhere within, 100 miles of where I'm at right now within the next 4 hours? 5 hours? Great, I'll be there. And what did I do? I tested that out. Not really purchasing anything, but said, hey, how can I get my hands on this right now? We're doing a disaster recovery test. You're part of this right now. I apologize. We're going to make you jump through hoops. Let's find out if we can do this. And we did. And we were successful in that. Lastly, there has to be a business continuity plan. What is a business continuity plan and how does that differ from the disaster recovery plan and the data backup plan? All of these are nested. A data backup plan is part of the disaster recovery plan. So we back up our data, but we have to know what to do with those backups. The disaster recovery plan is what happens if the IT section goes down. But the business continuity plan is the big, huge bad guy of all of these plans. And that is what happens if the entire company gets burned to the ground. How do we recover? How do we bring everything, at least whatever we can, back out of this company? Maybe restore this company, all of the insurance and whatnot. Maybe we can rebuild the company elsewhere. And that is one of those things where you have to have all of these things and you have to test these and you have to be aware of this and you have to be on top of things. Look, we're not always going to be able to bring everything back from the dead. But you know what? With proper planning, we can hope that we can do this. And we can hope and we can try. And yes, maybe we can keep people employed. But we can't do that if we don't think about it, we don't plan about it, and we don't act on it right away when we need to. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Hank, thank you very much for letting me have a few extra minutes this week. Back to you.
Thank you, Benjamin. Do batteries last longer in the refrigerator? I'm a throwback from yesteryears that storing batteries and photographic film in the refrigerator lengthens the life of the products. I no longer use photographic film, but I do have a need to use a variety of batteries. There are some types of rechargeable batteries, such as NiCad and nickel metal hydride batteries that self-discharge more quickly and may benefit from being stored at low temperature. Some experts also recommend storing lithium-ion batteries in the refrigerator at a 40% charge. They should never be put in the freezer. Lithium-ion batteries, found in laptops, high-end portable power tools, and mobile electronics, have a discharge rate of around 5% per month. Nickel-cadmium batteries, although not widely used today, were the first widely adopted rechargeable battery. Some batteries in some situations actually do benefit from refrigeration, but practically speaking, most of the time nobody should be putting their batteries in the refrigerator. The underlying principle is that the colder temperature slows the rate of energy discharge. Every battery has a rate of self-discharge. The rate at which it loses a percentage of its stored energy while just sitting there doing nothing. This self-discharge occurs because of what are known as side reactions, chemical reactions that occur within the battery even when there is no load applied to it. There's no way to avoid self-discharge, but improvements in battery design and manufacturing have significantly reduced how much energy is lost during storage. Here's how much common battery types typically discharge per month at room temperature. Alkaline batteries. These are your most common disposable batteries. They are quite shelf-stable and typically lose 1% or less of their charge per month. Lithium-ion batteries found in laptops, high-end portable power tools, and mobile electronics have a discharge rate of around 5% per month. NiCad batteries, or nickel-cadmium batteries, although not widely used today, can still be found on some portable power tools and other applications. The discharge rate on NiCad batteries is typically around 10% per month. Nickel metal hydride batteries largely replace NiCad batteries for consumer use. Early nickel metal hydride batteries had a rather high rate of discharge and could lose up to 30% of their charge per month. Low self-discharge nickel metal hydride batteries were introduced in 2005 and have a discharge rate around 1.25% per month, which is on a par with low discharge rate of disposable alkaline batteries. Looking at the discharge rates, It makes sense that in some applications, only a few people would want to put batteries in the refrigerator. To prolong the life of the battery and to maximize the time between recharge, do preserve battery life by switching off a device and removing the batteries when it's not being used and is not expected to be used for extended periods of time. Do practice proper battery storage by keeping batteries in a cool, dry place at normal room temperatures. It is not necessary to store batteries in a refrigerator. In order to understand why, it's helpful to have some insight into how a battery works. To keep things simple, we'll limit ourselves to common AA and AAA batteries and not smartphone or laptop batteries. To get technical for just one moment, batteries release energy because of a chemical reaction between two or more compounds stored inside. Electrons flow out of one terminal through whatever device they're powering and back into the other terminal. But even when they're not plugged in, those electrons can sneak invisibly out of the battery, draining their capacity through a process called self-discharge. It's easy to see how common wisdom would point towards a refrigerator as a solution. If you can slow down the chemical reaction, you should be able to store batteries longer without losing any juice. So should you? The answer from battery makers is somewhat surprising. All the major brands recommend a clean, dry room temperature environment. When stored properly, the discharge rate of a single-use alkaline battery, the most common type in the United States, is negligible, only about 3% per year. Single-use lithium batteries lose even less. If you've been storing batteries in the refrigerator, like me, don't kick yourself too hard. As it turns out, there's a good explanation why the myth exists. Rechargeable batteries then and now are likely the main reason so many people store batteries in the refrigerator. Up until a decade ago, the customer experience was pretty terrible and refrigerators were a stopgap measure. Nickel-cadmium and nickel-metal hydride batteries, the most commonly used rechargeable batteries, could lose as much as 20 to 30% of their capacity per month. A few months on the shelves and they were effectively dead and in need of a full recharge. At that time, storing these types of rechargeable batteries in the refrigerator was recommended by some as a way of slowing down a rapid loss. Fortunately, there have been significant improvements in rechargeable batteries. The Panasonic Eneloop Pro can maintain 85% of their full charge for up to a year at a time, so no refrigeration is required. What is room temperature? When battery makers recommend room temperature, they generally mean between 68 to 78 degrees Fahrenheit. Depending on your location, though, your house may get a lot warmer than that, and the hotter it gets, the faster your battery loses their charge. Stored in a hot garage or closet, those batteries could drain themselves out 2 to 4 times faster. Keep the battery dry. Yet another reason experts recommend not keeping batteries in the refrigerator is condensation. Humidity can impact batteries as a whole, and that's why it is recommended a dry storage environment should be used. You build up condensation in a refrigerator.
When to replace the rechargeable battery? As a battery gets older, it loses capacity. If the battery's capacity when new was 4,000 milliampere hours, and its current capacity is only 3,600 milliampere hours, that comes out to 90% of new. Then it has a battery wear level of 10%. That said, battery wear is mostly caused by deep charge cycles, that is charging to 100% and discharging to 0%. Wear level is the battery's capacity to hold a charge compared to its capacity when brand new. The wear level factor lowers the full charge capacity of the battery, which means a shorter battery uptime between battery recharges. Batteries are harder to measure than you might expect. Even something routine, measuring the battery's current charge, produces significant errors and inaccuracies. Battery health is a rough approximation at best. Worse still, the battery's organic chemical makeup introduces organic errors that cannot be overcome. Your battery's capacity may vary by a couple of percentage points each time you charge it, sometimes as much as 10%, So any battery health measurement you see could miss the mark by as much as 10%. While a battery will eventually wear to an annoying point, there are a couple of good practice tips to reduce battery wear and increase battery life. Reduce screen brightness to increase battery life. Hibernate and automatically turn off the screen. Install a solid-state drive. Remove or disable accessories. Basically, you can safely ignore any measurement of battery health above about 80%. Anything above 90% is perfect functionality. Only when your battery's health gets low and stays low consistently should you be concerned. Imagine your battery had a brand new capacity of 3,000 milliamp hours, and today your battery holds 2,880 milliamp hours. This is a 96% battery health, because your battery can now only hold 96% of the original capacity. Supposedly, this number approximates battery degradation and therefore battery status. Rechargeable batteries, like standard batteries, utilize an ionic chemical paste within them that provides the battery with its ability to be charged and to maintain a charge at full capacity. With non-rechargeable batteries, it is always assumed that the unit is purchased with a full charge and is discarded after it has been depleted. With rechargeable batteries, it's difficult to know if an older one is accepting a full charge. To see if a rechargeable battery is accepting a full charge, a multimeter may be used to test it after a charging cycle is completed. How would you measure the health of laptop battery, especially when it is non-removable? There are diagnostic tools available for Windows and Mac OS operating systems. HWinfo for PCs running Microsoft Windows is a professional hardware information and diagnostic tools supporting latest components, industry technologies, and standards. Both tools are targeted to recognize and extract the most possible amount of information about computers' hardware, which makes them suitable for users searching for driver updates, computer manufacturers, system integrators, and technical experts too. For those running Mac OS, there is Coconut Battery 3. With Coconut Battery 3, you are always aware of your current battery health. It shows you live information about the battery quality in your Mac, iPhone, and iPad. Every battery will be slightly different, every charge will give a slightly different reading, and every full capacity will be slightly different. No battery ever charges to 100%. I might add that when you purchase a replacement battery for your laptop, you may have no choice but to buy it from a third-party supplier, as the original manufacturer no longer has it available for older systems. Many batteries purchased are from China, and they tend to not have strict adherence to required specifications. Run HWinfo or Coconut Battery Diagnostics on these newly purchased items. I have also purchased original manufacturer battery for very old systems from third-party vendors. The wear level factor on some of these units were not acceptable, as they sat on the shelf for a very long time or were pulls from other systems. What about determining battery wear level on Android phones? There are secret Android common codes built into each cell phone. However, it is important to note and keep in mind that some of these codes are universal, while some are not, making some of the codes useless for some phones, while some are exclusive to specific manufacturers. Check for the common codes associated with each Android manufacturer. The pragmatic method to determine when to replace the rechargeable battery is when you find the uptime for use of the battery after recharging is annoyingly short. What if we could directly get our house to know the weather to make adjustments automatically? Marty Winston turns his weather eye to that information gap and talks about what can happen when houses themselves know the weather.
Think about being in a friendly, happy science fiction movie where your house is in many ways like a robot, able to sense things and able to respond to what it senses. Hey, wait, aren't we partway there today? Well, sure, in a way. Cars, too. One of the options that some cars offer can sense when it's raining to turn on its windshield wipers or turn them off automatically, so you don't have to deal with those half seconds of distraction. Same with turning the headlights on when it's dark and off again when the sun can light the road. Well, there's a house thing. Photoelectric controls have been around for a long time and can automatically turn the lights on and off. The outside lights, anyway. I guess we can treat sunlight as a weather phenomenon. So, what if your house could be even more plugged into the weather? What else could it do? Now, let me take a second right here to share a few significant points. One, there are several ways available today that your house can know the weather, at least in our sense here. And two, there are several products available today that can let your house respond to what it knows about the weather. No need to wait for George Jetson's house. If you do any software programming at all, you can get weather data as data from any number of sources that you can reach over the internet, many of them free. Well, you may have to register, but they're free, and your program requests data for your location. For some of these resources, the free version might limit how frequently you can ask. The data comes back in a kind of shorthand that even simple software can decipher. With a little online hunting, you may find routines or whole programs available to fetch and massage and otherwise beautify that information. Another option, one I especially like, takes advantage of the data that's available from the latest generation of weather stations. I have an AccuRite Atlas station and a Weatherflow Sky and Air station in my yard. Or, you know, you can use both. The benefits of the big services is that they incorporate a lot of information about major patterns that come from satellites, from radars, and from artificial intelligence algorithms that are very good at predicting what to expect and when. The benefit of a station in your own yard is that it's hyperlocal. It's not someone else's temperature, air pressure, humidity. It's all yours right now. And you can get updates all the time. I'm not going to get into the how and why of all that. Oh, did I just hear a huge sigh of relief? Now, I just want to make it very clear that there are several ways available right now to bring weather information in as data. Okay, then what? And by then, I mean then automatically what? So, back to the car. It would be silly if the car could detect that it's raining, but instead of engaging the wipers, it would just light an it's raining light. Or maybe it could talk to you.
Excuse me, driver, but just in case you're not looking out the window right now, I just want to be sure you're aware that it's raining.
You get it. The idea isn't adding to our to-do list, it's cutting us loose of those extra chores. And that brings me to a fast explanation of automation. Don't cringe. This is simple. Remember biology or psychology classes? It's a stimulus-response relationship. Ring a bell every time you feed a dog, and before long, the bell alone will get the dog to salivate. Bring a burning candle too near to my fingers, and I'll pull my hand away. In automation, it's the same kind of thing, broken down into three kinds of things. One is sensors, the things that signal the status of other things, they feel. One is actuators, the muscles. These are things that can respond with actions of one kind or another. Might be as simple as sending a text. And in the middle is a controller, which is simply something that says, if you sense this, do that. Sometimes all three, sensor, actuator, and controller, are tucked away inside one lone product. Light bulbs or night lights that turn on when it's dark off and when it's light, turn back off again. Well, those are examples of that. Everything's inside. But I want to remind you that this is a what-if circumstance. What if your house can know the weather? I don't want to get in how controllers will work or what they'll look like. In fact, all we have to consider is what can be possibly made to happen as a result of knowing the weather. What are the actuators that we want to actuate? What muscles are we going to exercise? What can pieces of the house do? You can buy things right now that can open and close windows. So when the conditions are just right, your house can automatically air itself out without wasting HVAC energy or wear and tear. Other gizmos can open and close blinds or shutters or curtains, which could help keep reflections off the TV screen, help prevent solar fading of your furniture, and help keep glare from bothering you. There are electrically retractable awnings, and retracting can be a good thing if major winds or high-volume rain or snowstorms are coming. And oncoming rain can be a reason not to let your scheduled automatic lawn watering happen. I've seen that a lot. Fog is a good reason to light driveways and garage lights. Forecasts of freezing temperatures could shut off the flow of water to your outdoor spigots. I think you get it. When a house knows the weather that's coming, and the weather that's happening now, you gain the opportunity to have it respond to that in ways that protect you and your family and the house itself. The yard, too. And if nothing else, it can't be all that hard to have your talking assistant volunteer a spoken warning. Technology today or coming soon can give us a house that, like so many of your friends and neighbors, is always ready to talk about the weather. And speaking of the weather, next time I have some information, and this is no snow job, about choices you may or may not want to make when it comes to snow removal, keeping your driveway drivable even when the driven snows try to drive you crazy. But crazier still, some of the nasty and costly surprises that can spring on you next spring and how to avoid those. Chilling prospects. But just maybe I can help clear your mind about making smart choices and find your best options when it's time to shovel your hovel.
Thank you, Marty. All I need now is some way to clean out the roof gutter and shovel the snow on the sidewalk. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, November the 14th, meeting time at 7 p.m., and there will be a presentation on record and publish videos on YouTube. Meetings at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 411, and that's in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, November the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center in Ewing has a presentation on Windows 10 features that you may not be aware of. Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that's ACGNJ, meets Friday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Shurer Hall. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is Hank at PCRadioshow.org. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and PCRadioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at PCRadioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.